Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 19th, 1999, and in the Creekside room this morning, Jennifer McCrickard will be doing her series Technology and Ethics, and this session will be entitled Choosing Technology, Who Decides and How? This tape is 99-5. So let's move over to the Creekside room for Jennifer's presentation.
Well, they get to see all the chipmunks who are living in the drainage field. there's thousands of chipmunks over there.
In the drainage field?
Because it's nice and warm. Oh. And they can live there all year round really happily. And apparently they just have all of these tunnels. I mean, it's just a whole little warren. That's for rabbits. I don't know what chipmunk communities are called, but...
And that has fouled up the drainage because it makes leaks in it, huh?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Huh. So the guy who told me this, he said that every guest needs to take out at least one chipmunk. That's the way to solve the problem.
I like that. We're supposed to pack out.
Well, and a couple of the chipmunks have been crawling into backpacks on their own accord, so they may be on board with this. Well, what I chose for my last topic in this session, in this series of ethics and technology, was how do we go about choosing technologies? Because it's really obvious that somebody somewhere has to make a choice about what's adopted and what isn't adopted. And then once you figure out who's going to do it, you have to figure out both who's going to do it and then how the decision's going to be made. And so there are a couple of discussions. Who are you looking for?
The subject is
technology and ethics.
Join our informal circle. We'll expand the circle. Mm-hmm.
You want to join the circle?
Sure.
And some of the possible, what we're talking about today is how do we choose different technologies and who should be doing the choosing? Because there are a bunch of different ways and choices have to be made. I mean, we can't just take a neutral position on technology, because if we take a neutral position, things are going to happen or things aren't going to happen. Something has to be done. We have to have some sort of system. And if we don't have a system, things are going to happen anyway, and we'll just be sitting around going, oh my gosh, what has happened? Some of the possibilities in terms of who could choose are consumers could choose, the voters could choose, experts could choose, or communities could choose, or some combination of all of those things. The ways that things could be chosen would be through some sort of cost-benefit analysis, through supply and demand, or through some other sorts of means. One example that I think really helps me to think about how important these choices are and how initial choices can have consequences that we really couldn't predict is the television. I think most people with the introduction of the television thought, well, it's not going to be that big of a deal. You know, we'll have it in our houses. But I think that if somebody had said, you know, if you put these things into your house, kids are going to start watching 6 and 7 hours of TV a day, people would have laughed in your face. They would have said, yeah, right, that's never, ever, ever going to happen. But that is what happened. And with the television, what you got, and this is one thing that I'm really interested in, is in the United States, we have so much focus on individual choice. But individual choice has a community effect. So if you think about it in terms of a neighborhood, if you move into a neighborhood and you've got some kids, and you decide that you don't want a TV in your house, but if all the other kids on the block have television, well, your kids aren't going to have much to do, and if you only have one, I mean, so with other individuals making decisions, it's going to affect you, even if you haven't made the decision to do what they've done. And the major example here at Holden has to do with VCRs. Different individuals have made individual decisions about their individual lives. They've decided, we want a VCR to get us through the very dark and boring nights of winter. But one thing that I've heard in terms of a criticism is that, well, now people, instead of getting together and having conversations and watching a movie or a video together, people go to their own separate chalets and plug in a Twilight Zone or Bugs Bunny or something else, and so everybody separates off. But what you have here is the community effect of a bunch of individual decisions. So that, I mean, I think that those are, that really interests me, because it's really difficult to predict and to even see or to anticipate how these individual decisions are going to affect people. The current decision that's going on here at Holden has to do with the satellite phones. Right now, you can't use any sort of phone here at Holden, but with the new technology, it's going to be pretty easy, pretty quickly, to have to be able to use a cell phone here. It's a satellite phone. And so there was a whole issue.
Without Holden doing anything?
Yes, without Holden doing anything.
They'll just bring them in.
They can bring them in because there'll be satellites that are circling around the Earth. And so you can use it here and it'll just connect up with the satellite.
It's part of that digital analog combined network. Mm-hmm. They're fairly pricey, but not that pricey.
Yeah.
And they're pricey now, but they won't be that pricey in a couple of years because the price goes down so rapidly. So Holden's in a position, or all the folks who are here at Holden need to do something. I mean, people can choose to do nothing, which means that phones will probably come in, or people can try and have a discussion about whether or not there ought to be phones here and try and predict what the effect might be. So those are some of the things that in terms of current decision making. Based on your experience, how do you think most, who makes most decisions about what technologies are adopted, and how are most of those decisions made, just based on your interaction with the world?
Yeah. From the list you gave us initially, I noticed that suppliers were not in that list. I would like to add suppliers, manufacturers, businesses to that list, and I would like to suggest it's a combination of suppliers and consumers.
And could you give me an example?
An example would be, violent video games, movies. I guess I'm looking for things that have some potential minuses to them. What are those little things that kids carry?
Game boys?
No, the ones you have to keep alive.
The pets.
I'm sorry, say again?
The virtual
some
pets?
They're
yes,
virtual pets.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I was losing
but they've got some sort of special name.
Yeah. Whoever makes those
or
has
rocks.
Did some preliminary studies and did some focus groups, and they had this prototype, and a dozen kids seemed to like it, so they said let's test market this in San Francisco, and it looked good in San Francisco. So they had a sense that there'd be acceptance and consumer demand, but they kind of created the demand by introducing the product, and they guess what? They were right. Product
and to make it just a little bit more sinister, what many of the suppliers also do, I heard this on NPR, is they will go to high schools and they will find the really cool kids and they will give the cool kids stuff. In the hope that that will create, because everybody will want to be like this person. This I heard, specifically with clothing.
That's what cigarette marketers do.
Four in a box.
When I started college.
And they were free.
Yes, when I started college.
Cigarettes? Are you talking
cigarettes?
Cigarettes. Really?
Oh, yeah. When I went to college and they gave them to the campus leaders.
And really?
Ours, I can't remember any but Marlboro, but I'm sure there were others, but they were free.
Salem's,
yeah. The shorthand and too simple is I just always have conceived of it as market-driven, so that's a very similar thing. The one that, most of them don't surprise me. The most recent one that surprised me was Beanie Babies. My sister-in-law has a shop in Leavenworth, and when she hangs the little heart out, that's all she has to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't see any customers all day. They're just, they block our door trying to get another Beanie Baby.
Wow.
And people went to Major League Baseball games, paid for the full $12 seat, got their Beanie Baby and left, didn't watch the baseball game.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they did take him out of schools because richer kids, like in a private school, richer kids would have more of them. And so it was a status symbol in fifth and sixth grade or fourth and fifth grade. And so they just had to say, you can't bring him to school anymore. It got really crazy.
In Dallas, the homeless people got sick of McDonald's Happy Meals because the mothers would keep driving through to get the miniature Beanie Babies that McDonald's were giving out. The mothers would buy all these Happy Meals to get the little miniature Beanie Babies and then give them to the homeless people. Wow. And there was actually a glut of Happy Meals among the homeless.
Wow, that's crazy.
See, in terms of technology, I've come to the realization that I'm very bad at predicting what's going to be accepted and what isn't, because my father is an inventor and he's trying to start his own business. And he used to ask me, you know, so do you think this will have much of a market? And I would say, no, Dad, that's not going to work at all. But then I realized that if somebody had asked me about car phones or cell phones, I would have said it is the worst possible idea in the world because nobody wants to be attached to a phone all the time. But I was obviously wrong on that one. So I think I'm just very bad at predicting. I think John.
Going back to your TV, I was up at Holden when this statistic came out. In the surveys they do, and they do surveys about everything, it was about 10 years ago that the survey, how do you best like to experience nature? You know, a guided tour, a hike on your own, a trip, what have you. 52% was on television.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Really? Discovery Channel, probably.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, I think Mutual of Omaha Wild Kingdom trained us to want to sit in the comfort of our living room.
And,
And I didn't even realize till I was probably in my late 20s that Mutual of Omaha was actually a corporation that was sponsoring that. I thought it was Mutual of Omaha Wild Kingdom. That was part of the title. I didn't know it was worse meant.
Well, I have a question. Like, we've talked about fertility, and that is certainly consumer driven, isn't it? Well, not just consumer driven. I think the medical, I mean, you said they really do want to help, but I think there's also this thing, scientists by nature want to see how far they can go, and so an interest is created among people who would be interested in this. And together they push it together.
Yeah, I think it's definitely together, because if you think about like cryogenics, I mean, people want to live forever. And so if there are people who are willing to come up with ways that will allow us to live together, there's always going to be somebody who's willing to buy it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What would be, I mean, do you think that the market and supply and demand is an appropriate way to go about choosing technologies? And if not, what would be a preferable way to go about choosing, or who should be choosing, what technologies are adopted and what aren't adopted? I think it's very easy for me to sit back and say, the whole market system is corrupt and clearly things are going really poorly. But it's far more difficult for me to figure out what would be a preferable option.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly the capitalistic way. I mean,
but we do, I mean, even in a highly capitalist society, we do have ways of discouraging certain products. I mean, mm-hmm. we have taxing, mm-hmm. we have laws, we have, I mean, so there are many different ways on a federal and a state level, just in terms of government, but there are also ways that communities can make decisions. There are some neighborhoods that, I mean, and this may not be a good example, but that your house has to be a certain color, or that you can't have satellite dishes. So communities do make decisions together.
Well, and there's big corporations that also limit what you can buy at their stores, depending on if they don't agree with how product,
right.
Like Walmart is.
Yeah, Walmart will sell a bunch of things.
With records, I know for sure, but I'm sure they do it with other, like with toys or, you know, that kind of thing also. You know, I'm sure it doesn't stop just with records.
But there are definitely two parts to this, and I think it's difficult to really extricate the two of them. But the one is the who, and the other is the how, mm-hmm. because I mean those are distinct questions. But I'm not sure that they can be entirely separated from one another.
In the defense of the capitalist market system, I think the last 10 years or so suggests that although it may not be the best system with the best possible outcomes, I'm not arguing that, but on a making comparative rather than absolute judgments, I think it does a pretty good job compared with other ways of making joint decisions. I think as a nation, we run better than most communist countries run. I think quality of life is higher on average.
Well, let me throw something out. I have flown this or floated this idea with my students of the question of capitalism versus democracy. In a market-driven system, what you basically get is the people who have the money are making the decisions about what sorts of technology are going to be in society. In a radically democratic society, it wouldn't simply be the people who had the money who are making the decisions. So what I offered to my students was the possibility that a market-driven choice that market and democracy may not be compatible, or there may be definite tensions between the two of them. They, of course, vehemently disagree, so I... that's an available option for you, too.
To get back to his comment and your list of possible ones, in my mind, it has to be some combination of those. I can remember here at Holden a session that said the environmental crisis probably will not be solved in the United States unless it becomes profitable to be ecologically sound. The full cost of your pollution of something or your taking of a non-renewable resource will be into the product, and it will be detrimental to be a polluter. So that would have taken some either government, like you said, taxes or what have you, but then the market will go into work because that's the way we work.
Right.
So I think it'll take some combination of that kind of thing. There was a marvelous book that said that we really have this country that I think all of us are appreciative of, I am, when capitalism was connected with such strong assumptions of hard work, of really kind of prudent living, of rich people being quite charitable, the Rockefellers and others.
Yeah.
So you had these values that helped control, and the book ended, book was written a long time ago. If those values leave, this is the most vicious thing you can imagine what's going to happen in this country. I mean, it was just a shock to read
you
kind of saw what would happen if those controls, which are strong if they're cultural assumptions and habits of the heart, would say we have lost a lot of them.
Yeah.
And this is the most individualistic
society. Interestingly, Adam Smith, I mean, who was the father of capitalism, one of the major assumptions he had was that everybody had an innate moral sense.
Yes, yes.
I mean,
another way to say it.
I mean, that was just necessary for capitalism as far as he was concerned. And we have gotten farther and farther away from that, probably with the introduction of social Darwinism and the idea that survival of the fittest.
Well, I think we just recently got away from that. I mean, there was the era of robber baron capitalists who were not really nice folks, and the solution to that was federal legislation. So I'm not arguing against having legislative controls. I mean, I think one reason our capitalist system works as well as it does here is we have cool things like Security and Exchange Commission. You know, it's really easy to buy stock in this country, and you know that the corporation exists, and when you read the annual statement, you know that these are accurate numbers, and it's because of the SEC. You know, if you go to a lot of other places, you can't make those assumptions. There are not standard accounting practices, so I think, you know, legislation regulation is great, and it acts to create. I believe it's possible that this moral outlook not only drives the regulatory agencies, but some of the regulations drive our expectations. So I think the causal links are recursive.
So how should we decide about cell phones here at Holden, or cloning for people who are having difficulties having children, or where some of the other things I've talked about.
In vitro.
I think it's in vitro fertilization. It's really hard for us to get, well, maybe this is an answering question, to do the moral stuff on a governmental level. I mean, you have to have that, almost have to have that democracy stuff working against the capitalism to get some moral regulations or whatever. And it's hard to for us to think socially because we're so individualistic. I mean, we came up with that at, that was majority part of those community meetings talking about VCRs and blah, blah, blah. That was eat up this, you could see this tension of individual self rights and communal good and for the communal good. What is the line? And you could tell everybody's lines are different places. I mean, and so I don't know how we get a whole country thinking communally.
Well, some people have argued that we need to really redefine what rights are,
mm-hmm.
and that the whole idea of rights has outlived its usefulness,
mm-hmm.
and that we have this idea in the United States of absolute rights, that I should be able to do whatever I want and it doesn't matter what the costs are. And so there's been some suggestion that we need to change our understanding of rights. And the example used was in terms of jet skis on lakes. That many people argue it is my right to have a jet ski.
They pollute more than the big boats.
Right, and but I mean, so it's this serious tension. And there's another example, which is really a very interesting example because it went to the court, and the courts actually cited, well, here, I'll give you the example. It was automatic dialers that call you at home and they ask you, da-da-da-da-da. Everybody finds
an average of four a day.
Oh, they're horrible.
And
well, the trick is to tell them, please take me off your list, and they are now legally required.
There's nobody there.
Oh.
Most of the time,
yeah,
because it dials so many,
yeah.
And if I'm not the first one to pick it up, I just get a dead sound.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And I called our own phone company, and they said, we cannot stop. We're sorry. It's not us. And they described how it worked.
And the court case, but the court case was,
there's nobody to talk to. It says you have waited too long to dial. Please dial again after a month.
Somebody tried to pass a law against this.
Uh-huh.
And the auto dialers, the people who are using these, took it to court. They argued that this law violated their right to free speech. Which the court agreed with. You have a right to say whatever you want. You have a right to call people and talk to them if you want. And so the laws right now, it's so focused on this whole rights idea. And I mean, and it's a very long-standing tradition and one that I support, that my exercising my rights, if I want to argue for communism and it irritates my entire city, the mere fact that I'm irritating my entire city is not a good enough reason for them to say that I can't talk about communism. And so the auto dialers were making the same argument. They said, look, the mere fact that this irritates a lot of people isn't a good enough reason to curtail our right to free speech. So it's not simply that people are being stupid. Once the courts start to say it's okay to curtail free speech for this reason, it very quickly has some implications in some areas where I think that we're fairly uncomfortable. But it's that tension between the individual and the community that I think that we really butt into.
Yeah.
If we were to use democracy or to try and get some sort of consensus, what's the best reasoning to use? I mean, should there be a cost-benefit analysis? How do we go about making choices?
I think the choices we're trying to make now are the fact that we just don't seem to be able to do them. I mean, we still have...
Like what?
Pro-choice.
Uh-huh.
I mean, how long have we been talking about this one?
Mm-hmm.
We can't make that one. How are we going to... We can't get agreement. I worked for a while in Phoenix on some pornography issues and was aghast to realize that some people thought the book I had bought for my children was pornography because it talked about a penis. You know, are you there, God? It's me, Margaret, talks a tiny bit about masturbation. Was trying to take off, they tried to take it off the shelves in Phoenix. No, we can't agree on what's pornography. We can't agree on, how are we going to agree on this?
Because nobody meets in the middle and things end up getting to the poles. Yeah. I mean, what happens is you end up with extremes because nobody wants to give from this side or from that side.
Do we just need to keep teaching moral deliberation? I mean, having that as part of our civic duty and training, you know?
Does it help if you start the conversation about the decision should be made at the lowest possible level of the people concerned, or at the highest, like a federal law? Does it help to start there and see where people are? And then, I mean, should some school districts be able to kick that book out of the library and other parents be able to have it in the library without the whole state having to do the same thing?
That's what happened in Arizona. Uh-huh, you know? Uh-huh. Some school districts did not have these books and others.
I can tell you what's going to happen if you have decision making at the grassroots level. What's going to happen is the variability in decisions that are made is going to be greater. So it's going to be a really, really odd kind of social structure where it's okay to have hustlers in Hustler magazine in third grade classes in one community, and it's not okay to read
Culture.
Thank you. In high school in another community. And I'd also like to make a comment on your note about consensus building. I think what happens in our social structure is like-minded people get together. You know, I'm in favor of free speech, and this group is in favor of control of pornography. And rather than coming together, when we get together with like-minded individuals, I think groups tend to move apart. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how polarization happens.
Well, we do live in a place, we live in a state that makes a lot of decisions at the local level. We live in a semi-dry town. I can buy beer and wine in Denton, but I cannot buy my Kalupa. There are places in Dallas where you cannot, whole neighborhoods, whole areas, you can't buy any alcohol, no beer, no wine, Kalupa, anything. And then there'll be another area over here where it's wide open. And the whole state is like that. It's totally local. And so you can make these decisions there, but I don't think it would work for technology, you know.
Can I interject? I came in late, but I wanted to interject something in terms of cell phones, VCRs, and so forth at Holden. Being a salesman myself, I have 3 voicemails, a pager, and a cell phone. It wasn't my lack of fortitude, but rather the thought that I could actually come to Holden and escape those. I mean, it was sorry, there's no signal. And so that's what I was able to leave on my 3 voicemails, is I will be unavailable and unable to return phone calls. And from a family perspective, my wife and I just talked about this the other night, was, boy, look at them. They're keeping busy without Nintendo and popping a movie into the VCR. And we have physically unplugged, I'm almost embarrassed to admit this, 2 of the 3 TVs that we have in our house. We've kind of accumulated them over the years. But trying to put it into a spot where we can regulate what they're watching, we've disconnected 2 of them. But still, you know, I've got an 8-year-old that will run into the house off of the school bus, plop down, and boom, 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 start, you know, you got to physically turn it off, you know, let's go out and find your friends, let's play catch, you got a ball game tomorrow night. So that has been another good reason for us as a family to be up here at Holden and say, now, on the other side, I can understand that the people that live in community here are here 365 days a year, and the winters are long, you know, but in terms of opening it up to the
community in general, the coming and going community. That's one of the reasons why I like it here. Because I'll tell you, if it was open to cell phones, again, I could probably lie, although I'm not very good at that, and say I'm unavailable for that week.
Well, it's not lying. Saying I'm unavailable.
But if somebody's went off next to me, I'll bet after 2 or 3 days I'd be saying, mind if I bottle that for just a second? I'll use my calling card. Just to check my voicemail. Just in case there's an emergency or...
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is that, I mean, and this is one thing I think is interesting with my students as well, is that they almost relish a top-down decision because they're not strong enough to make that decision themselves. And this comes up in my classes just in terms of paper assignments. And my students don't like this, and I was talking with Jim Martin Schramm this morning about this. I tell my students, you have to turn in 2 papers during the semester. When's the deadline? No deadline, I need to be in by the end of the semester. They hate that. Because invariably they're trying to write 2 papers in the last week of school and they know they're gonna get horrible grades on them. And so they say, well, we just wish you would be more authoritarian. Do you think that's how, I mean, and I have also said that in terms of my own day-to-day living, if people just took certain things away from me, I'd be able to cope just fine. I mean, I'm a big advocate of taxes. Because I have all these high ideals, and yes, I'll give money to those people, but when push comes to shove, every month I find lots of other ways to spend my money, and I just don't have very much willpower. But if I'm able to quickly get somebody and say, okay, you just need to coerce me once a year to give them lots of money, I'm great with that, because I'm much better at sort of saying, okay, you must make me do this, than making the decision on my own. So in terms of technology, I think it's what's interesting is if you talk to most people, they would say, yes, my life would be so much better if I didn't have that. But I'm not capable of making those decisions on my own. What is that?
Well, where do you think that came from, though? I mean, I don't think it was always that way. I think early on, say pioneer days, when you were self-sufficient, you were dependent on making decisions for yourself. Regulation was fairly non-existent except for squatters, you know, I mean, in terms of taking over land, occupying it, and then assuming that land as a responsibility. But I don't know, where do you think that, where we've kind of given up that responsibility that comes with rights? I mean, that's the other side of rights.
I think that the reason, that, and I agree with you, that we like kind of the top-down decision making, and I think the reason we like it is there are some distinct advantages that come to my mind. One of them is it's fair. We all have to play by the same rules. Now, I may not like the tax structure. I may like progressive tax structures better than regressive tax structures, but we all play by the same rules, and that's really, really nice. And there, if you don't play by the rules, there are prohibitions. So it has a sense of justice to it. The rules are clear, kind of, sort of. It's hard to do the taxes, but I mean, and that gives me a sense of satisfaction. I mean, maybe you can tell by tonal inflection. I'm pleased with this. I'm pleased that corporations use the same accounting practices. I know what they mean. You know, it makes me feel good. I can sleep easy at night because I know what the rules are.
Well, I think that we could spend a lot of time trying to figure out why we're this way. But the question is, the interesting question for me is, given that we are this way, what's the best way to go about making decisions?
Well, your list included the experts. And who would they be?
Who are the experts? That's my question.
I lived in Washington, D.C., and I met some congresspeople. They're not, I mean, they were elected for reasons other than their expertise. is it a brain trust? Is it the science community?
Those are all available options.
Yeah. Well, with a good selection problem, I'll go with trusting some experts who have more knowledge and insight. And but you'd like to think that the expert also has a level of, well, to enlist, morality and kind of unselfishness, not driven by his or her own self-interest. So it's
the moral genius.
Yeah.
So in this cloning thing, you know, as people are making discoveries, all this was written up in the journals in their profession.
Is what cloning you said?
Yes, with cloning or in vitro or any of this stuff. You know, as they're making progress in this, they were writing papers because they need to be published. So all of this is in the journals that other people are reading it and getting ideas from it. People in their community, you know, in their profession, and taking it a step further. Now, these people, I don't really know, were they interested in the moral implications, or were they just interested in how far they pushed it? Should somebody else, some other group of people, the philosophers, be reading all these journal articles and saying, wait, before it actually gets to the public?
Well, what's interesting about cloning and interesting about many of these technologies, with cloning, when it was first reported, when Dolly was cloned, or when Dolly was the result of it, I don't know which one happened, immediately, some major church organization in Europe came out against it categorically, I mean, like within 24 hours. And very rapidly, just about everybody's had this knee-jerk, very bad. And Clinton said, you know, pass a law against it, can't be doing this anymore. But when you go and you ask folks, well, why did you make this decision? It was like, well, we don't, I mean, that just was just wrong. And now that people have been talking about it more, there have been many people have begun to back down and say, well, you know, maybe we were a bit hasty. But one of the other things that's interesting is that in terms of laws that are passed, it seems as if the less likely it is that something will actually happen, the more likely it is to be prohibited. So human cloning was just completely off limits when people thought it would never happen. But now that it's become more likely that it will happen, it has now shifted to well, we might let this be legal. And so there's always the question of, you know, what's pushing what?
The deliberation and decision, yeah.
Which, and I'm not sure that the public is all that more capable, but it's just really interesting that as things become more possible, it's like, well, you know, it's not so bad. We'll do that too. So just, I mean, it's a very interesting and moderately disheartening process, because it appears as if there isn't a whole lot of deliberation that's been going on. And I suspect that, John, in terms of talking about experts, you would probably want some checks and balances in terms of the community folks. And the, I think that one of the good examples here has to do with nuclear technology, in terms of nuclear power plants, that the experts said, you know, this is perfectly safe, it can go right here, it'll be cost effective, all this sort of stuff. And the neighborhoods said, well, no, wait a minute, we're not okay with this. And so there was actually quite a bit of difficulty getting trying to work things out so that experts and the community could actually interact with each other, and that the community actually had some power in the decision making.
And it's assuming there's a community that is specifically impacted. When there's a physical building that's being created, there's a community. When there's not, there's much less pull to become involved.
And the entire environmental rights movement, or environmental ethicists, their concern has been, well, when it's just human beings making decisions, we basically use a cost-benefit analysis. And there are a bunch of problems with cost-benefit analysis, even just for humans. We tend to look at the short term and put far more weight on the short term than the long term. We aren't really good at predicting what the costs and the benefits are going to be. And we tend to discount all of the costs and the benefits to people who are other than us or to the environment. So there really begins to get, it gets really difficult really quickly to make these decisions. I want to put one thing up on the board that I find really interesting. It was an idea, Langdon Winner is somebody who has written a lot on technology and ethics, and he has this idea, this doesn't have wheels on it,
he calls it, just so people can see it, his idea for how to make choices called epistemological Luddism. And epistemology has to do with the theory of knowledge, how we come to know things, how we come to believe things, what counts as truth, what counts as knowledge, what's merely belief. Luddism, anybody know what Luddism is? The Luddites? Mm-hmm. Who are the Luddites? The Unabomber. He was a Luddite. People who were just opposed to technology. During the 18th century, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the Luddites were folks who just, they destroyed all of their machines because they thought that machines were beginning to control them. So Luddites today have been people who just reject technology. That's been the idea. Now, in terms of my understanding of technology, it is literally impossible to reject technology. The chairs you are sitting on are technology. But what Winner's idea was in terms of epistemological Luddism, what he realized was that technologies, the adoption of technologies, we cannot anticipate how they're going to change our lives. I don't think it was possible for most people to anticipate how computers would affect our lives. I think if you asked people 50 years ago, when a computer filled this room and still couldn't do as much as my little laptop does, if you had said, what's the effect on computers going to be in the world, they would have said, well, you know, maybe you'll see them in science labs doing long formulas really quickly. But other than that, you're not going to see computers around a lot. So what Winner found interesting, and the problem he saw with technology, is that we do all this deliberation, we think about it, we make what we think is a really good decision, and then this technology affects our lives in a way that we couldn't have possibly predicted. But it's really difficult once you have a technology to back away from it. And I think that that's one of the problems with technology is that sort of, well, we'll just try this out for a while. But if you just try something out for a while, it's really difficult to give it up because you very quickly become dependent on it. His idea of epistemological Luddism is the idea that if something breaks down, you don't fix it. Or you make a conscious decision to go without something for a while. So this would be after the technology has been adopted, you make a conscious decision to stop using it, just for a while, just for a test period, to see if your life is better without the technology or with the technology. Because at this point, you will know what your life is like with the technology, and you take it away for a while, and you can see, well, what's it like without the technology? Which is better? Now, I think that it's probably easiest in terms of things breaking down. I think it's going to be a lot more difficult to make the conscious decision. But I know that some families do in terms of television. They'll say, okay, we're not going to watch TV. This probably worked best during the summer months because they're all reruns. We're not going to watch TV for 2 months. This is how I think. I can go without ER for 2 months if it's reruns. And maybe I will begin to discover that my life is actually better for those 2 months. But some of the things that I think are interesting are the bigger things. Could you get an entire community or a neighborhood to go without cars for a month or for a week? It would be really interesting if you could. I mean, and it might not be the entire city, but it might be just the neighborhood. And you might discover at the end, you know, this is really not the way that we go. This was a really boneheaded decision. So let's go back and have the cars. But to me, this is a really interesting idea, and I've tried to push it at my university to see, well, what sorts of things could we give up, mm-hmm. just to see what it would be like. And what happened at Holden over the winter I thought was really interesting. Over the winter, Holden had very little electricity. Mm-hmm. I mean, it went down to what? How many watts 30, did it?
Almost 38 or 35 kilowatts.
This would be forced epistemological Luddism.
Yeah.
All of Holden had to figure out what they were going to do with very little electricity. And what I find really interesting about the people I've spoken with about this time period is everybody talks about what a wonderful experience it was. It created community, all this other sort of stuff. But as soon as the all of the electricity was available again, everybody just went back to it. And what Winter would say is, take that moment where you had very little electricity and think about what it did to your community. Think about how it affected the community, and then possibly make a conscious decision to just live on that much electricity. Now, it could be that the community said, well, yeah, between the two, it built community and that was great, but quite frankly, we like refrigeration and we like lights and we liked all these other things.
Well, the snow's gone, so you can't put your stuff in the snow.
Right. But the idea that he has is to deliberately put yourself in that position where you can say, okay, what would my life be like without this technology? Because I think what happens so much in this society is we get so used to having it that we can't imagine not having it. I can't imagine my life without a car. I mean, it's very difficult for me to imagine without an answering machine. But my answering machine just broke. It doesn't work. So I'm really thinking about maybe I just won't replace the answering machine. What will happen then? What do you all think about this idea of epistemological Luddism as a way of making choices about technology?
I like it. Yeah. Can we legislate it?
More intentional.
I think it's really something that we need to think about. Because the way technology is going, unless we stop and think about how it's affecting us, both positive and negative, we're never going to know. And that's the scary part. It may really end up controlling our lives instead of we control our own,
which is
our
exactly
own destiny, our own life.
Which is exactly what you say about having like a gazillion pagers and all that. And I like start getting my like a rash when you say that. It's like, because I remember. I mean, I think coming here to Holden, you do a little bit of that. Whether you're here for a week, you get a little sense of, when I was here with my congregation, I went, oh my goodness, these people like sit on porches and talk to each other. I mean, it took us a couple of days, but you know, we got there. And kids played in the dirt and it was wonderful. And we were here for just a week, but I think of the phone stuff, and it'll be interesting when I'm not here, what I do with that. I mean, I think of the winter, couldn't use my hair dryer, dry my clothes. I have to say, I really look forward to drying my clothes again because that's just so easy. But I don't use my hair dryer anymore because I don't really need it, and I can't believe I thought I did, you know. And so there's a few things like that that just it's kind of like giving something up for Lent and then realizing, oh, I didn't really need it anyway. And
right.
That happened through our process too, talking to some people saying, well, I gave it for Lent and I just didn't really need it after.
It's interesting when you are forced to go through that process. My dryer broke, and over the winter in Minnesota, the humidity is really low. So I chose to hang my clothes, you know, inside, and moisture improved. It was a little stiff, the towel, but so what? It made you feel more invigorated after a shower. Decided after I had gone through this, and now in the summertime you hang it outside and you have that wonderful smell and you bring it in. Pooey on a dryer. I don't know how to replace it. Don't need to. Don't need to. That's just one small choice.
For the whole, I don't think Joel, I think I got up to all Joel's sessions, but we've had a week on technology without any mention of appropriate technology. E.F. Schubert, whether his definitions were right or not, his attempt, I think, is a good one. And a combination of epistemologically, Luddism, that led to appropriate technology because we tested it to see whether it was not only more beneficial for us or not beneficial for us, but tested and how did the earth do with it or without it. But if there were some ways to test it and we didn't become slaves to it, but we used that which was helpful and we rejected that which wasn't, is a nice step forward. I don't think you can legislate it. Maybe you could. I don't know. But it's kind of a nice combination.
Yeah. I used to say, and tongue-in-cheek, please, but that Bill Gates was the Antichrist.
I mean,
I think you'd probably take your tongue out of your cheek, right?
I wonder at what point, you know, we're talking about enslaving, and my biggest issue with technology is it seems it gets us further and further from face-to-face contact. Mm-hmm. And being in sales, I'm looking for the day when all I have to do is flip up my laptop, turn up the camera, dial somebody up and say, "Hey John, how you doing? You guys need anything? Are you looking?" I mean, I don't even have to be present. I'm here.
I think it's important to remember, though, that we still have agency and autonomy. I mean, to say that we are slaves to technology, I think, is unfair to people who have actually been enslaved. Because people who have actually been enslaved, they didn't choose to be enslaved. To say that we're enslaved to technology, I think, is a real watering down of the word enslaved. Because I freely enter into all of my, I mean, I buy technology, I'm there, I'm with it 100%, and I need to be home Thursday nights to watch ER. I mean, that is me. I mean, for me to say that NBC must-see TV has enslaved me, I mean, I think it's really important to remember that we do have choice.
But addicts choose the dope the first time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's true. But then the snag is, it catches them, and they...
My point is that it's basically a critical mass issue. It's, you start in little bits, like a drug addict, and it works its way into the culture, and it works its way into capitalism. And so a larger question is, you know, does capitalism, is capitalism directly opposed to community? You know, I'm just saying the further we get down this road is, yeah, I need my laptop because the competition has a laptop. It can get him to where he wants to be faster. I've got to get there faster than him. I mean, so it's that issue also.
But I also want to push the point that technology doesn't necessarily lead to less face-to-face contact. I mean, I know many people because of technology that I would not know otherwise. Because of the internet, I have met lots of people. I have been supported by lots of people on the internet, and I have given support to lots of people. So I think that, I mean, there are different ways that it can be used back and forth, but many people find the internet to just be a saving grace. I mean, people who are bound to their homes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think it's an either or option. I think that that it gets really easy to say, ooh, all technology bad, we should just get rid of it all. What's neat about this idea is that Winter isn't saying give up all technology. He's saying give it up for a while. You may find that your life is better without it, but you may also find that no, you really needed it. So, I mean, I think you're right that lots of people do get carried away with it, and it may serve to make us do less face-to-face. I mean, we go through drive-through windows and all this other sort of stuff, and I refuse to go through drive-through windows.
So are we changing our definition of community? Is community...
See, you missed that day. We had a whole day in community.
Yeah, that was a whole day. it is a little discouraging when you think whether or not this will sell. I think it was St. Paul... There was an offer that if any family gave up their TV for a month, they got a $100 bill, right. And they got no takers.
Yeah, no takers.
The neighbors probably would have done that.
I see examples of people doing this kind of around the edges, and I think that's a great place to make changes, kind of around the edges, the clothes dryer example, you know, when a television breaks. I think it would be really, really difficult to get even a small community to engage in this on a voluntary basis.
Really?
And a large community, I think it would be nigh to impossible. I only know of one community, I'm not sure if it still does this, that prohibits driving automobiles one day of the week. It's a place called Ocean Grove, New Jersey. It's a very small community that is owned by a very conservative religious group. And basically, what they, since they own the town, what they do is they put up chains across the streets that connect Ocean Grove to the rest of the universe. And you just don't drive. And if you happen to have driven into Ocean Grove, New Jersey on Saturday night, it would be a really good idea to get your car out of there.
Before the chains go up.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, that's their decision, but their decision, I believe, was not made because of concerns about technology, but rather...
But go back. I thought you were going down a way and then you lost me. This was a fringe, the dryer.
Right.
But and what's television. The center? Television and dryers, so what's the center that we won't do?
Well, we won't do it on a community level. That's what I'm suggesting. I'm saying that's nigh to impossible, and I gave an example of in my 42 years, I just know of one kind of community example, and it was for a completely different reason.
Let me give just one answer. It should be easier on a community level.
Where they
give me an example.
I gave some in the session that Ray and I did on... three families, one dryer. So when you really needed it, you had one. Or several families, one car, with a group of people that didn't need it daily for work. They lived in the middle of D.C. and they could walk or take the bus and what have you. But sometimes it was nice to have this car that three families own rather than go rent one. It made sense for three families to own one car. Or the fact that you would have a community of people when you did give up some of the technology to do the things you did in the winter in the way of having people to react to instead of being isolated completely. I mean, there should be some things that make it easier with a group of people who came to a common decision. But
so a self-created community can do it.
Yes.
And maybe that's the common factor with these folks in Ocean Grove, New Jersey. They were a self-created community.
So if you weren't in Ocean Grove, but you had a faith community in the middle of the city, the faith community could choose it even though your town didn't do it.
And then for the faith communities, doing the no TV for a week, or let's cut out all meetings for this week so that we can spend time with one another otherwise. And and also in Germany, my friends who live in Germany have a car with about three other people, and that they just lease out, they have a leasing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you forget that we do belong to a community that tries to buy only organic food.
Mm-hmm.
And only do co-ops to support the organic farmers and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a small community that we belong to.
I guess I was thinking more of
big technical stuff.
Well, and physical communities with geographic boundaries.
Yeah.
See, the place that I think that it would work the best, and I'm going to try and push this at my university, is the university context. Because I think in a university context, particularly when most of the students live on campus, there is a geographical community, and it might be possible to get some sort of momentum. But I could also imagine at the city hall just sort of saying, okay, for Sunday afternoons, we won't drive our cars. I mean, that seems possible to me. And I think it's a really interesting idea. And what I like the most about this is that it's not knee-jerk in either reaction. It's taking seriously the idea that we don't know what technology is going to do to our lives before we have it.
Just out of curiosity, who is the author? What is his work and what?
He Langdon Winner is, he is very critical of technology. He's a philosopher. He is concerned that technology has a life of its own, and that if we don't take control of it, it will take control of us. So that's where he's coming from.
Okay.
He's a philosopher.
Do you know, rhetorically, are there any Amish that are concerned about Y2K?
Well, they probably ought to be. I mean, this gets back to the first part that I brought up, is that even if you in your community aren't using technology, you're still within a larger context. So, I mean, if the entire United States goes into some sort of financial crisis, I'm guessing that the Amish would probably be hurt by that. They probably won't have any immediate impact in terms of stuff. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there are any
any computer technology. I mean, it's
I'm just wondering, they didn't anticipate that the card would not, when they came up with the computer card, would not accept digits over 2000. But
they anticipated it. They just thought that it would be replaced by the time the year 2000 came around.
So
you know, it was that way when they started with that.
So I'm wondering what else is out there that, because we're moving so quickly, we haven't anticipated.
Well, we are out of time, so I'll leave you with that apocalyptic thought.